We'll move on to that. Steve Bregman from Horizon Kinetics. He's the president and co-founder of the firm. Horizon's one of, for those of you who don't know, one of the largest independent research firms in the country. They do a lot of really great work on structurally inefficient market sectors. They do a lot of great stuff on spinoff and distressed debt work. A friend of mine had sent me a piece that these guys had wrote on passive investing and how it's really affecting price discovery. And I called them up, and they were very gracious enough to come down and speak to us today. This is a topic that's been on my mind a lot lately. It's really affecting probably everybody in this room, active versus passive investing. And I think Steve has a really unique way of kind of framing out some of the concepts here. And I think you all will be very interested in that. And then he also has some very interesting thoughts on cryptocurrency, and he's going to share some thoughts on that as well. And before I do bring up Steve, there are some there's a compilation of his research books out in the hallway. If you want to pick that up, I would ask you to please drop off your card. I love these guys to come down here. If you have a chance to subscribe to their stuff, I would certainly encourage you to do so. They sent me a book, and it's fantastic reading. It's certainly worth taking a look at. So with that, I'll go ahead and turn it over to Steve.
Thank you, Dave. Hi. First of all, can you hear me? Is this good? Okay. So for those of you who are active investors, who believe in fundamental analysis and relating security valuations to sustainable returns on capital or to book value or to payback periods, let me say, it's not your fault. If you harbor some doubt about your talent after years of underperforming the accepted benchmarks of competence, then maybe, maybe I can buck you up with this list of luminary value investors renowned for their superior long-term records. Here we go. Fascinating, isn't it? So, because Mary Gabelli and Chuck Royce and David Berkowitz, who was named manager of the decade not so long ago, and David Einhorn, they each have different styles, areas of expertise. They favor different techniques. They're of varying generations. The only thing they share is that they are value investors and they buy on the basis of their own fundamental research. So what's the statistical likelihood that this highly divergent set of portfolios with very little overlap could all underperform the market in not one or two, but three and four successive years? And not by a handful of basis points, but by 1,000 or 2,000 basis points at a clip. It's unprecedented. Is it possible they all lost their touch at the same time? They all got stupid together? So either they're the anomaly or they're not. And if they're not the anomaly, maybe the market is the anomaly. So on a simplistic level, the reason that Mary Gabelli, despite suffering years of outflows, underperforms is because he refuses to alter his methods. He's simply not going to buy a retailer like Under Armour at 70 plus times earnings, or a retailer like Amazon at 180 plus times earnings, or a content reseller like Netflix at 100 plus times earnings. So he underperforms. But on a deeper level, it has everything to do with the indexation bubble we've been witness to in the 10 years since the credit crisis. And one would be hard put to find, I think, more than one or two value stocks in the entirety of the S&P 500. As a bubble, I dare say, it's the greatest bubble ever. And that strikes many as outlandish, particularly with volatility so low and the overall PE ratio not inordinately high in the context of low interest rates. That's what the statistical models say, at any rate. But what if the models themselves and the unprecedented low volatility are part of and symptomatic of the bubble? For me to explain that, though, I think one first needs to understand the history of how we got from there, or what used to be normal, to here, where Longleaf Partners is considered passe at best and incompetent at worst. I apologize in advance. There are all sorts of exhibits that have been left on the editing room floor. I hated to do it because this first part of my presentation, the index bubble tour itself, usually consumes a full hour. So I needed to highly edit it to get to the what happens next part. The what happens next part is good news for active value managers, and especially I think for small cap managers. And that one usually consumes a full hour. So I hope I haven't abridged this so much that it loses its oomph. So let's get to the broad market valuation items out of the way first. So first chart, just to relieve the analysts from having to explain the ever-recurring, non-recurring events like the impact of tax law changes or currency translation effects or special gains, one can just look at the stock market's trailing five-year PE ratio. It smooths out all the rough spots. So in the last 130-plus years, it's been this high or higher only twice before, once in December 1999, which was on the eve of the collapse of the internet tech bubble, and in 1937, not because prices were so high, but because earnings disappeared. I'm sure you've seen a chart like this before here and there. But that's the second best measure, in my opinion, of market valuation. Here's what I think is the first best. You don't need any analysts whatsoever to explain anything. That's simply the aggregate market capitalization of all U.S. stocks relative to GDP, as pure as it gets. Basically, the market value of publicly traded equities relative to the productive capacity of the U.S. economy. And that ratio, which is just shy of 1.5 now, has only been higher once in the 73 years for which we have data, just shy of that. And that, again, was the eve of the tech bubble collapse in 1999. No other market high comes close. You need a 50% market drop just to get back to average. Now, none of this happens in a vacuum. Okay, a critical element that contributed to these all-time highs in equity valuations is interest rates, which have basically been coming down to the lowest rates in 5,000 years of recorded financial history. And there are records to back that up. They've been coming down for 35 years, which is two full generations or one full working life of an investment professional since they peaked at 15% or so in 1981. And that process, of course, accelerated in the trauma of the credit crisis of 2007 and aided by an historically unprecedented coordination by the world's central banks to bring interest rates to an artificially low level, basically zero. Now, let's not slide by this too quickly. History happens at inflection points. And if you're not aware that we now exist at several historical records or extremes, then you can't prepare. A perceptual challenge to people, I notice, is that there's no great pinnacle of valuation, such as during the internet bubble. I would liken that market to being in a little boat way offshore at sea, and you see a water spout. And you can look up, you can see it, and you can go, wow. But there's not a lot of energy in it. It's mostly wind and mist, and the tech bubble did not engulf the entire market. And today's bubble, I would liken more to being at sea with the entire sea level rising by 2 or 3 feet. As a tsunami wave does far from shore, you might not even be aware that it's happening. Not very volatile, but it contains an astounding amount of energy. So, which brings us to today's bubble, delivered by the modernized style of indexation with ETFs as the primary delivery vehicle. And the sheer weight of money flowing into these instruments has distorted clearing prices in every sort of financial asset in every corner of the globe that it takes place. But it is indexation is not in and of itself the root cause. Rather, it's the business end of it, which is the ETF industry, being the animating force. And it's helped create a massive systemic risk to which everyone who thinks they are well diversified in the traditional sense are really now exposed. And the process by which we came here is important because it's sequence dependent. An action in the marketplace doesn't just happen in a vacuum. Okay, it's noticed. It's responded to. It creates some excess flow of demand. That demand gets gamed for business opportunity. The public is eventually brought in wholesale and so forth and so on. So understanding how the process has manifested itself informs you how to sidestep the inevitable damage. Okay? So I'm going to proceed with just a handful of the endless examples of the distortions caused by formulaic basket-based investing and how it's been blindly moving trillions of dollars of assets in very particular directions and how it's created a bifurcated market like no other in history, which I'll call the ETF divide, and how this mechanistic approach has not merely distorted valuations, but of much deeper concern is it's disrupted the price discovery mechanism. So to whet the appetite, I've just been speaking in abstraction so far, I'll give you all a friendly test, a rhetorical test, but a test. And it's a valuation sobriety test, okay? And I'm just going to use the bond market because you can argue stock valuations till you're the blue in the face. There are just too many variables and suppositions, and you can't get anywhere. But there's not so much room for debate on bond pricing. Okay? So, just some benchmarks here. U.S. Treasury note, 10-year Treasury note, yields about 3%. Is it reasonable for the extra credit risk that a 10-year single-A corporate like J.P. Morgan Chase trades for 1 percentage point higher, 4%? I think reasonable minds might agree that it's a sound premium. And would another percentage point to 5% yield be reasonable for a 9-year single B company, but one with an enormous equity cushion like Netflix? Okay. So the sobriety test will consist of some top 10 holdings in the iShares, okay, the iShares Emerging Markets High Yield Bond ETF, EMHY. And the question for each is, what price for the extra risk? So as another frame of reference, the weighted average maturity of the U.S. iShares High Yield Corporate Bond ETF is 6.0%. Okay, just so you have a frame of reference. So first up, 12-year Russian Federation bonds. The country's sovereign debt is not investment grade. Anybody hazard a guess? Don't raise your hand if you know, but only if you don't know. Yield? Anybody? No takers? There's no wrong answer. 20%. Huh? 40? 20? Okay. 20. Well, let's go one more. 9-year note of Kazakhstan's state-owned gas company, also not investment grade. Yield? No wrong answers. Okay. By the way, Russian credits are one of the largest weights in EMHY at over 7%. Lebanon, cowering in just about the lousiest neighborhood in the Middle East, the size of New Jersey, could erupt in civil war at any moment. That's a 3.5% weight. And by the way, this ETF is one of your bogeys if you're a bond manager. It returned 15% almost in 2016 and 9% in 2017. So, what are the yields of these bonds? Okay, so you notice that the Russian Federation 12-year bonds traded only a 30 basis point premium to the 10-year U.S. Treasury and lower than 10-year IBM bonds or J.P. Morgan Chase. And really, how does a landlocked nation that relies on Russia to export its oil to Europe borrow more cheaply than Netflix and not that much more than J.P. Morgan Chase? And by the way, the iShares, as you see, Emerging Markets High Yield Bond ETF trades at a lower yield than the U.S. High Yield Corporate Bond Index. So, here's the mental proof. Would anyone seriously argue that these yields are adequate compensation for the risk? And if you buy them at these yields or prices through the ETF, and the ETF were to disband for some reason and return these bonds to you in kind, do you think you could sell them at these prices? Okay. If not, do the prices result from some other factor? By regulation, when money comes into EMHY, the allocations have to be done promptly and according to their precise index weight. It's not relevant in this context that the external debt of the entirety of Kazakhstan, the supply, is all of $160 billion, which is not much more than the cash balances of Microsoft. Okay? There's just not that much supply of many of these credits to go around relative to the global institutional money allocations to emerging market bond sector. So there's no factor in the algorithm for valuation. There's no analyst at the ETF organizer. There's no, or at the pension fund or the consulting agency who's concerned with it. It's not in the job description. There really is no price discovery. And if there's no price discovery, is there really a market? In which case, what is this ETF really worth? So this is all about artificial supply and demand pressures related to the business of ETF creation. And now take this exercise and the lessons of it, if you took a lesson from it, and apply it to the equity indexes. That's what's going on. It's just tougher to debate. Okay? So if element number one in the creation of this bubble was zero interest rates, which created desperation for yield, there is an intersection with element number two, which was a long, slow march toward indexation and the development, a bit more of a decade beforehand, of the first ETF as a better mousetrap to a mutual fund that could be priced by the minute, could trade like a stock, and was cheaper. Okay? And those two trends, the juncture of interest rates and the availability and awareness of ETFs, coincided with the credit crisis of 2007. Because at that moment, every level of market participant, from the retail buyer up through the institutional investor and pension fund consultant, wanted away from volatility. Okay? They wanted away from security-specific risk, from sector-specific risk, away from it all. And it lent an urgency to the indexation movement. Because at its simplest utility, instead of my buying my favorite REIT, which might be the one that goes to zero, I could buy an REIT ETF. And it might not do great, but at least I know it won't go to zero, and it'll have better volatility statistics, and I'm partly measured on that. So money began pouring out of actively managed equities and into indexed instruments, and without a single annual exception, even during the early years when money was actively leaving equities overall. I'm sure you've seen charts like this before, but essentially that's a $4 trillion swing from active management into indexation. It's an astounding amount of supply and demand. Okay? But ETFs are the key. It's not index funds as a class. Indexation, as originally proposed by the academic founding fathers, people such as Harry Markowitz and Fisher Black, and originally practiced by Jack Bogle, founder of Vanguard, envisioned owning the entire market. You make a long-term asset allocation decision with very little adjustment. They wouldn't actually recognize what's happening now. So now to the business of indexation. One of the great effects of the credit crisis was the acceleration of indexation as a business, not merely as a tool to measure performance or necessarily to participate passively in the flows. So the ETF manufacturers were actually all set at their 85 basis points or whatever they charged to be a comfortable oligopoly, except, and it could have worked, except for the confounding factor of Vanguard, which is a non-for-profit institution, and every time they got a bit more assets and scale economies went up, they dropped their prices. So unit costs dominated, fees compressed for the mainstream indexes, and ETF companies, even robo-advisors, can't make a living at 5 basis points. They couldn't compete head-to-head with Vanguard in the plain vanilla funds like the S&P 500 or the Russell 1000. And that's important because it makes ETFs as a product a low-fee business. And in order to be profitable, therefore, it must be done in scale. If an iShares new product analyst comes up with a new ETF and it collects all of $100 or $200 million, they might as well not bother. It's not even worth it. So a new ETF can't be limited in its scalability by companies, let's say at the lower levels of the weighting structure, by companies with limited market cap or trading liquidity. Ergo, the index rule set will be tinkered with to exclude those and focus on large and mega-cap companies. And the population of those is fairly limited. And business being business, the other way you handle that is product differentiation. Okay, that's the thing. So that's not new. It's been done before for cigarettes and for alcohol and for shampoo. Okay, that's why we have this proliferation of subsets of the market for what you can charge a higher fee for. The country funds, the sector funds, the style funds, and so forth. So I'll show you now a few different classifications of ETFs, what they say they are in terms of asset allocation and portfolio theory, and what they really are. Okay? So let's start with the foundational principle of indexation, which is what? Diversification of security-specific risk. That's what they're supposed to be offering. But with time, a market capitalization-weighted index, and that's the methodology they use, tends to get concentrated. So investors in the iShares Energy ETF presumed to be buying a diversified portfolio. They fled idiosyncratic risk. I don't believe most of them know that just about 50% of the fund is in just 4 companies, that they've actually fled right back to buying idiosyncratic risk. And what happened to British Petroleum in the Gulf of Mexico not too long ago could happen to ExxonMobil. In fact, it did. It was called the Exxon Valdez disaster. So do investors, for instance, know that the largest 10 positions in the iShares Spain ETF account for 71% of the fund? So that's semantic investing or semantic misinvesting. It's got nothing to do with fundamental analysis or even exposure. Here, two examples of industrial scale and semantic misinvesting internationally. So coming back to the Spain ETF, do pension fund consultants know that 7 of the top 10 holdings get an average of 78% from their revenues from outside of Spain? Much the same for the iShares Italy ETF. Do consultants' asset allocation programs incorporate that? Do the robo-advisors? I don't think so. So I could show you the same for emerging markets, where you don't get exposure to the truly dynamic local companies that represent true growth. You get exposure to the large cap, mostly export-based companies, whose growth is dependent, rather, on the developed nations to which they export. So now let's return to the main market, S&P 500. So let's say, another thought experiment, that in 2013, on a bench in a train station, you came up across a page torn from an ExxonMobil 2012 financial statement that a time traveler from 2018 had inadvertently left behind. So there it is before you, detailed factual knowledge of Exxon's results 4 years in the future. You'd know everything. Oil prices down 30%, revenue down 45%, earnings down 67%, the dividend payout ratio ballooning to almost 2x earnings, except for, like a morality tale, the stock price. And if you shorted, you would have lost quite a bit of money after your cost of carry. Because the financial statements didn't mention the era of industrial scale investing, which requires highly liquid shares. And Exxon, being about the most liquid, is accordingly raw material for any ETF that requires scale and can tinker with its rule set to include it. There you will find it in demand. So aside from being 25% of the iShares Energy ETF and 22% of the Vanguard Energy ETF and so forth, Exxon is simultaneously a dividend growth stock. It's a deep value stock. It's in the USA Quality Factor ETF. It's in the Tail Hedge ETF. You get this. It's both a momentum tilt stock and a beta stock. It sounds like a vaudeville act. And you'll find this in well over 100 ETFs. So essentially, the company's stock has been denatured, commoditized, and is no longer reflecting the changing value of the business, but rather the demand for its shares by index funds. And the ExxonMobil phenomenon can be seen in almost any of the largest S&P 500 constituents. Money has been structurally channeled into the most liquid securities anywhere in the world that ETFs have been directed in size. And it even shows up in global correlation statistics. So in the last decade, ETF money flows into the relatively few companies in overseas markets that are large enough and liquid enough to accommodate them have resulted in record low volatility and correlations that have converged with ours. So even Mexico and Japan, I mean, can you find two more different cultures and economies and geographic locations are now more correlated with the S&P 500 than the top S&P 500 companies were a couple of decades ago and have the same correlations with the S&P 500 as a diverse range of U.S. sectors, industry sectors. Unless one thinks the ExxonMobil phenomenon is specific to the cyclicality of the oil market, McDonald's growth from the 2008 crisis year at the bottom of the economy to 2017, a wonderful period of time, was actually, anybody know what the revenue growth was? McDonald's, 10 years? No wrong answers. Huh? Louder? Yeah, most people say 3, 4, 5. How about negative? The fastest growing element of McDonald's financial profile is its debt. The fastest growing elements of its market profiles is its P.E. ratio. Same story with the other blue chips. You can look at any of them. They basically reached the per capita limit for how much soda and disposable diapers and mayonnaise can be sold. It's not their fault. It's just the way the world is. Okay? But not so long ago, valuations would have contracted as growth slowed. It's obvious, right? Investors voted with their feet. But I exaggerate slightly, but I hope you understand. Nobody bought McDonald's lately individually. They bought it as part of a basket. And since they didn't buy the shares individually, they can't sell them individually. All they can do is sell the basket. So I ask you again, where's the price discovery? A common view of these S&P 500 companies, many people will say, is that at 22 or 25 times earnings, is that low interest rates justify the high valuations. Now, that's been true historically, but it's also true that historically these are growth companies. And because of this narrowness, when somebody asks you, how's the market? I get asked that question all the time. I have to return the question, which market? Because even within the S&P 500 itself, let's say in 2017, the S&P 500 revenue growth was up 8.9%. Take away four companies, Amazon, Facebook, Alphabet, Netflix, it was 5.3%, meaning 40% of the revenue growth of the entire market came from those four companies. In 2016, the S&P 500 revenue growth rate was 4%. Without just those four companies, it was negative. Okay? So how do they, the big they, address this risk? Well, in the financial realm, risk has come to be measured by historical price volatility. So we've got standard deviation, we've got beta, and consequently, enormous effort is devoted to finding low volatility sectors with sufficient liquidity. So let's have some fun with the beta. As I've covered already, collapsing fees necessitated more exotic or esoteric ETFs that could charge higher fees. But an impediment, though, it's almost impossible to launch a new ETF unless it backtests well. And backtesting well means it has to have a low beta. So name a major index, and odds are it will have a low beta. How they do it is anybody's guess, although you can look. So here are two lists. One is a selection of the some better and perhaps lesser well-known ETFs with among the lowest risk measures. And the other shows the largest and most popular value ETFs. I can't go through all the examples, so let's just look at the iShares Frontier 100 ETF. If you don't know what Frontier means in this context, it's the emerging markets of the emerging markets. Okay? This has a beta of 0.4, meaning it's 60%, supposedly, less risky than the S&P 500. Among the more interesting of its top five allocations, but by no means the most interesting, Nigeria, home of Boko Haram. Now, call me picky, but is it weird that an emerging markets ETF has 60% lower risk, according to the accepted statistics, than the S&P 500? So how do they do that? Well, one way is the automatic bid, right? Remember the Kazakhstan bonds, same dynamic. But there's another way. So beta is not necessarily, in this case, measuring the emerging markets. That right-hand column there of numbers are the weightings in each of these ETFs in financials. And most of them are ambitiously overweighted relative to the S&P 500. And so what you're really buying in some cases, perhaps, maybe you're just buying exposure to financials. Nevertheless, these portfolios can be legitimately characterized as low risk since the financial sector hasn't been volatile, which assists the ETF in attaining its advertised low beta, which assists in money raising. But low volatility is certainly not an inherent characteristic of the financial sector, and I dare say most people would not argue that the volatility of the financial sector will stay low if interest rates rise. So you can see how the use of historical statistics actually distorts the risk analysis problem, at least when they're being the statistics are being employed for asset gathering and ETF creation as opposed to investing. Okay, it pains me to leave out all the other samples of market distortions. Even PEs are distorted. PEs are often not what you think they are, the way they're presented. I can't go into it here. So these have mostly been examples from the edge, so I can make a point a little more easily. But I'll leave you with one picture that says most of what you need to know about stock market systemic risk. Are we all aware that the Swiss National Bank is buying the U.S. stock market? It's been doing so for years. According to the Form 13F filed with the SEC, the most recent one, it holds $93 billion of U.S. equities, which would make it the fourth largest ETF in the country. So we now have a central bank intervening, for whatever its reasons, in our market. And they're buying blind the very same most liquid stocks. So the bank owns over 2,600 stocks, and only 260 of them, the top 10%, account for over three-quarters of the value of the portfolio. That's how concentrated it all is. It's all the same money flows. So today's equity portfolio manager, now I'm coming to you, is no longer competing in the market auction process with other buyers with limited capital. We're competing with a government buyer, a buyer not motivated by ordinary considerations of value. So can one say there's any price discovery? And without price discovery, unimpeded by intervention, there can be no rational allocation of capital. But that's the very premise that securities prices reflect fair value of modern portfolio theory and indexation. So the idea of being diversified as a way of achieving safety is broken down. People have fled from risk, and yet they're right back to as greater risk, maybe greater. So in broad brushstrokes, this covers some of the high points of the ETF waterfront. There are plenty of ways to buy a reasonable bond or earnings yield. It's just that the mainstream instruments cannot be that price. They're all priced for their utility as liquid trading instruments, and they incorporate tremendous amounts of systemic risk. Now, one question people ask is, why can't this just keep going on? Maybe indexation flows don't stop, performance and valuations of those stocks stay high and always outperform. And the answer harkens back to the 10-year flow of funds chart I showed earlier. It's pretty clear that the flow of funds into index products is being supplied or funded by the bank of active management. But the amount of assets under active management is finite, and that's pretty measurable. And you can compare that to the amount of the rate of outflow or the rate of inflow into ETFs, and is only a certain number of years before that is exhausted. And it won't go to zero in any case, because some people just aren't leaving Marigabelli. And as well, the flows just don't drop off a cliff and stop. They start to peter out first. So think about what happens when ETF inflows slow or stop. As with any bubble, what exactly happens at that moment? Well, the marginal trade, and prices are made on the margin, since the credit crisis, has been the index buyer, the automatic bid for index-centric stocks. But when that stops, the baton, if you will, then passes to the active manager. And the active manager might not be a buyer of Amazon or Coca-Cola or McDonald's. No more automatic bid, perhaps an absence of bids. And that's going to be interesting. But I doubt it'll even take that long, because that's several years. Because of this issue of float. Now, there are a lot of issues of float that are quite interesting, and I'll just touch on one. I think we'll start to reach certain limits within a few years. So there are the proponents of passive investing, many of them assert that indexation only has roughly a 37% market share, although there are wide estimates by different parties, but we'll use that one, and that all the rest is subject to price discovery by active management, and so that, ergo, the market works. Now, let's just use this as a starting point. And we'll use Amazon.com, because everybody likes to use that as an example, as a starting point. So they have 17% inside ownership, and therefore by the definition of float, float is 83%. Simple. But the concept of float presumes that any holder could offer to sell shares at any moment if the price is sufficiently high or enticing. But for an index fund, there's no such thing as an enticing price. There's only an efficient price. The price is always presumed to be efficient, and the ETF transaction rules are written that way. So the ETF fund can either gain market share or lose market share. That's the way it goes, inflows or outflows. If index funds are in expansion mode, which they are, then they cannot be sellers, whatever the price of the security in question, because they're net buyers. So if the index funds hold 37% of Amazon shares, give or take, and inside ownership is another 17%, then is it not the case that the real float would be 100% less those two sets of shares, in which case the available float now is really only 46%, which is a minority of the share base, and so we're already in uncharted territory. Now, to make it clearer, what if indexation continues to expand, let's say at a 15% per annum rate? It's actually expanded at a 20% annual rate the last 5 years and the last 3 years. But at 15% growth rate, by the end of 5 years, by the end of 2022, index market share will be nearly 75%. So in that case, if inside ownership is still 17%, can you really say the float is 83%? In practical terms, the float would be less than 9% of the shares. And by the way, between now and then, there could be a serious melt up in that stock. So in reality, the only circumstance under which index fund holdings of Amazon are available for trading is in the event of net client outflow. The methodological flaw in indexation's definition of float is that it's recursive, meaning it defines itself in terms of itself. The answer is defined in terms of itself. And there was a once popular recursive statement that is self-referential, which in its way also has to do with supply and demand. And that came from the mouth of famed Yankee catcher and manager Yogi Berra, who once observed, nobody goes there anymore. It's too crowded. Well, we don't go there anymore either. Accordingly, indexation must now take place outside. Excuse me, investing must take place outside the indexation sphere of focus and away from systemic risk. Now, there are two ways to do that. Conventionally, you can do it within the system, but away from the indexation vortex, and I'll cover that first. Then I'll cover two new asset classes, and that's saying a lot, two new asset classes that are outside the system. Okay, they probably hold, I'll say this slowly, the greatest investment potential my business partners and I have ever witnessed, and I think, in fact, the greatest wealth transference possibility in history. Okay? As to answers within the system, the beauty of the markets is that for the tide of money to flow in one direction, it has to drain from somewhere else, and that somewhere else means securities on the other side of the ETF divide. Those relatively invisible securities that are not actively evaluated or priced. You can find companies with pristine balance sheets that are highly profitable, that are growing, even with share prices that have doubled or tripled in recent years, yet which don't have a single Wall Street estimate. And that might not surprise this crowd. It might surprise a different crowd, not this crowd. The efficient market has passed them by. The ETF divide, the good news is, the ETF divide has created a massive price umbrella for the active value manager. Now, the reality of the markets, though, is that this avenue can't be available for the majority of investors if, say, indexation at some point decides to reallocate to small caps, because stocks below $2 billion, as you see here, and you might well know, given what you do, amount to less than 5% of equity market value. There's just not enough to go around. So in a way, one can no longer afford to be broadly diversified. One needs to be less diversified so that one doesn't overlap into the systemic risk and the same systemic risk. So what you need is, I think, and we're doing it, fewer securities, but with sufficient idiosyncratic features and optionality. They might do well or poorly, but the point is they'll do it on their own recognizance, not because of a change in the Fed rate outlook or the dollar exchange rate. So paradoxically, that's what diversification must now be. Now, one useful search variable here is trading liquidity. Okay? If you're willing to take a bit of illiquidity risk, your degrees of freedom and optionality expand enormously. Now, in this exhibit here, pay attention to the two rows marked by the arrows, and what they show is, for two different industry sectors, a distinct and direct relationship between average daily trading volume and valuation. Now, there are some very small companies in this list, and there are also some larger companies, because it's not about market capitalization per se. It's about liquidity. It's a liquidity-driven market, and this is one way to be on the other side of it. So here's one technique, and you can think of your own, one technique for locating companies that exhibit purely liquidity-based discounts like this, and it was used to create the lower table in this slide. You could examine, for instance, all the publicly traded companies in a geographic market that is underrepresented in the indexes. So Norway, for instance, is only a 23 basis point position in the MSCI All Country World Index. It simply will not attract more than 23 basis points of global institutional money flows. More than that, there are only five Norwegian companies in the index. How many can you fit in, right? There are a lot more than five Norwegian companies around. So you'll find some very interesting names in Norway. And you could do the same exercise, for instance, by industry sector, such as marine shipping, which is, by coincidence as well, only a 23 basis point position in the MSCI All Country World Index ex-US. So you could overlap the two lists like a Venn diagram and see what you find. And here you have three of those four companies on this slide, and the fourth one, A.P. Møller - Mærsk, is a Danish company. So I'll give you one company example. I decided to not base this upon individual companies this speech. Subsea 7, I don't know if any of you are aware of it. It's not the only such company, okay? There are more. It does underwater engineering work for major multinational and sovereign oil companies. It has 37% lower revenues than in 2012. The shares are more than 40% lower than in 2012. Its industry is in a severe downturn, to say the least. There have been scores of bankruptcies. However, being an owner-operated company, this company has more cash and net current assets than all non-current liabilities. It's had positive cash earnings each year of the downturn. It's repurchased 17% of its shares since 2012, including almost 4% last year. Book value rose by 7% last year. It's been acquiring related businesses. Valuation, the shares trade at 6.6 times trailing free cash flow, 0.8 times book value, which is almost entirely tangible. I think everyone can agree, or most everyone here can probably agree, that there is no substantive risk of this company going out of business. In which case, without existential risk, you hold a perpetual free call option on the eventual recovery of deepwater oil drilling activity. A stock like this could triple, no problem. But wait, there's more. It has a renewable energy business, think offshore wind farms and their engineering requirements, that contributed 24% of revenues last year and hardly existed 3 years ago, and it's growing rapidly. So Subsea 7 embodies a margin of safety with true portfolio diversification characteristics and really substantive optionality that one simply can't locate in the index-centric universe, and it's going to outperform eventually. So the same applies to income securities. I'm not going to dwell on this. I don't have time. You can build an income segment in a portfolio with an entirely different clearing price than the benchmarks, say an average 6% plus yield, plus long-term equity or purchasing power optionality, which absolutely does not exist in conventional income indexes. And in the same manner as for equities, you just need to find securities that are excluded by the indexation rule set. They might lack institutional scale liquidity or lot size. It might be the wrong maturity. It might be a non-standard structure. Okay. Now, the broader question is how asset allocation should take place this new version of public market investing as opposed to the way it is done. Okay. Now, I propose that it must take place the following way. First, indexation is not going away. There are ways to improve it, to construct better predictive indexes, but it's here to stay, which is not to say that the asset allocation process can't adjust. So allocators in the future, I think, or I hope, after a sufficient period of unsatisfying results, may seek out active managers who demonstrate a specific and value-added skill. And it might be industry-specific, or it might be an analytical technique that's independent of specific industries, but these will be very idiosyncratic portfolios. And accordingly, these managers are not going to be benchmarked relative to the standards because the comparison will obviously be erroneous. They'll be judged on some more relevant absolute basis over some specifically relevant time frame. And if they don't measure up, they'll be dismissed and the funds by default will go back into indexes. The point is that indexation will be the default and managers will be chosen because they contribute a differentiated and value-added characteristic. No room for index huggers or diversified style managers. But they best not repeat the mistakes of the past because active managers have been guilty of the same sins that ETF organizers are now committing and sowed the seeds of their own troubles. That with some success, managers devolved from being asset managers to being asset gatherers, and they either destroyed their own niche inefficiencies or they ventured outside their circle of competence. So, after all of this, if you have a hankering for some protection for your in-system assets, I'll conclude with a brief introduction to the ultimate non-systemic asset class. And it's two asset classes, really. Done properly, I should take a full hour to describe it in basic terms. You should take an hour to clear your heads, take a walk, and then another hour to ask me questions, at the least. And I only have a few minutes to do this. I'm going to take a different approach. And rather than explain it properly in terms of definition and technology and historical context, what I'm going to do, I'm going to do two things. First, I'm going to explain how high it can go in success mode. And then I'll address, or debunk rather, a few of the most strident criticisms of it. And I have to leave out all the meat, although there are some extra slides in case anyone wants to peruse them afterwards. And I'm talking about cryptocurrency and Bitcoin in particular, okay? A non-fiat fixed supply currency, meaning a non-dilutable money and store of value outside of government capacity to debase or control, an object of desire for 5,000 years. And it's been made possible only now by the march of technology. Not that the idea didn't exist. There's a guy named Friedrich Hayek who wrote about it quite a number of decades ago. It might represent the greatest transfer of wealth opportunity in human history. I'm quite willing to defend this statement. If Bitcoin achieves market acceptance as a parallel currency, not going to take away other currencies, just a parallel currency, it could easily appreciate a thousandfold. And this can be quantified. Okay? That means, just as an example, a 25 basis point position, which defines your one-time risk, could permanently change your financial life or the financial life of a client. Meaning, in dollar terms, a $100,000 portfolio, risk $250. It could become a $350,000 portfolio, or you can lose $250. If that stratospheric level of return seems outlandish, it shouldn't really, because you've all seen it. You've seen it before. So the IBM PC was rolled out in August 1981, primarily for the office market. The internet was a decade plus away. Microsoft, which provided the operating system for the PC, came public in early 1986. How many times your money would you have made if you bought Microsoft almost any time during most of that first year? It didn't have to be at the IPO, and held it for 15 years to year end 1999 at the end of the internet tech bubble. Anybody hazard a guess? 646. Meaning, in a $100,000 account, if you'd risked $1,000 and every other security went to zero, you would have ended up with a $646,000 portfolio. I feel like an inspirational speaker. so how many of you stand up? No. You didn't have to understand technology or software to make that decision. You just had to consider the what if. I didn't do it. I was not a believer. I didn't think. Not that many people owned a PC in 1983. So you could have asked, what if 10 or 20 years from now, it's actually popular? I mean, IBM was backing it. IBM of those days. So the thing is that by 1999, pretty much every household in the developed world that wanted a PC in their bedroom had one, with the Microsoft software buried inside. So that was simply a study in a product going from minimal market penetration to market saturation over the course of 15 years. You can think of Bitcoin in the most simplistic sense, in terms of possibility, the same way. Now, why crypto? The US dollar has been the reserve currency of the world for a century, give or take. Only the Swiss franc has been as strong. Despite that, over the past 75 years, the dollar has depreciated by 93% in real terms. That's the best you can do. That's the best you can do, because the government keeps printing more than it should. Every one of the thousands of currencies that have existed throughout time, every single one has collapsed. Anybody seen a Florence florin lately? That was the reserve currency of Europe for 150-odd years, roughly around 1300. So it's a wired world. People will catch on to the possibility of holding a stable currency. People in Brazil and Chile and other places, they buy dollars and hold them. Why wouldn't they buy this? So just a few of the scale possibilities, not all of them. Should Bitcoin ultimately be accepted as a parallel currency, are shown in this chart. Global M2 money supply alone is $90 trillion. There's $0.16 trillion worth of Bitcoin, and the unit supply is fixed. So the difference between potential demand and supply can only be equilibrated by a higher price or market capitalization, which in this case, just for this asset class, without any other considerations, just as a snapshot in time, is 500-fold. Now, it does carry real risks. Unfortunately, that's where too many people stop thinking, and that's what I want to address. I'll finish up with that, okay? So, because I've almost exhausted my time, the most efficient use of this time might be to go through some of the most well-publicized of these risks, working backwards rather than trying to describe it from the ground up. Because unless you've studied this topic directly for yourself, you've heard or read wildly divergent media commentary. And I can assure you, if that's the level of your understanding, almost everything you've heard or read is either flat-out incorrect or based on an insufficiency of facts. So I'll give you like a simple example. Not so long ago, I heard a very well-known, very well-respected asset manager, and I respect him too. He was being asked on television about his view of Bitcoin. And he tried to give, he's not a believer, he tried to give a thoughtful response, and he had a number of points. I only remember the last point. which was, he said, for Bitcoin to be successful practically as a transactional currency, he doesn't see it. Because for $10,000 per coin, like, what can you buy with it? How many things can you buy? Well, the fact is, it's in the code. It's the only thing that can be. Each Bitcoin is divisible into 1/100,000,000th of a coin, which is 1 × 10⁻⁸ power, or roughly equivalent to 1/10,000th of a penny. It's breathtakingly divisible, which means he hadn't read so much as a fact sheet. But he's being asked a question, he's trying to answer, and that's what people listen to. Next, the bubble argument. Bubble argument's important with respect to Bitcoin itself. The global consulting firm Capgemini, you might have come across some repeats of their findings in Forbes and Fortune for a few weeks in late last year. They concluded a study of how many millionaires there are in the world. I have no idea. I didn't read the study myself. I just read the blurb, how they did that. But they concluded specifically there were 16.5 million millionaires in the world near year-end 2017, which is a very interesting figure because at the time, there were just about precisely 16.5 million Bitcoin. So, what if Bitcoin is an utter failure in terms of market acceptance in that the only people in the world who wish to own Bitcoin are the millionaires, the 16.5 million millionaires. None of the other 99.9% of the planet wants it. So moreover, each millionaire only wants one coin and no more. So that would be demand for 16.5 million coins. And in order to get that, that means that's 100% excess demand relative to the supply. The only way for them to get it would be if every existing holder of Bitcoin is not a millionaire, parts with 100% of their holdings. Think about that. So a lot can go wrong with Bitcoin, but it's not a bubble. To be a bubble, everybody has to be in. Everybody's going to be in. Nobody's in. And as to the more than 1,600-odd cryptocurrencies, yes, there's a bubble there, just not in Bitcoin. So many of those 1,600-odd cryptocurrencies are poorly conceived, or they're poorly designed, or they have no proprietary value. And more importantly, none of them have a non-inflationary monetary policy, only a half a dozen or so. And the latter are the ones, the only ones that have long-term worth as a store of value. Although many will have value as business applications. You talk about technology, you talk about this and that and the other, get into the weeds on this. The only thing that's valuable about Bitcoin, it's technology enabled, but the only thing that gives it value, really, is it's the first currency in the world that's non-dilutable. Fixed store of value. Government suppression, the big one. Forget about Japan, which altered its banking laws last year to make Bitcoin a legal form of payment, that they licensed 12 cryptocurrency exchanges, that they're moving their entire money transfer system to a blockchain application of Ethereum. We'll just stick with the U.S. Okay? In December, the Commodity Futures Trading Commission approved both the CME and CBOE to establish Bitcoin futures. In February, the chairman of the CFTC made a comprehensive presentation to the Senate Banking Committee that essentially said that Bitcoin and cryptocurrency are here to stay and that the best thing the regulators could do would be to support its development. In February, the Arizona Senate approved a bill to permit taxes to be paid via Bitcoin. In April, the Ways and Means Committee of the House of Representatives there approved the bill. Then it goes to the full House, then it goes to the governor. Arizona might be the first state to approve Bitcoin for tax payment. On its website, the Federal Reserve Bank of St. Louis has been publishing a series of articles and tutorials about Bitcoin and cryptocurrencies, including white papers by its economists and these simplified FAQs or facts for the average reader. Here's just one excerpt that reads as if I wrote it. We conclude that Bitcoin has a wide range of interesting applications and that crypto assets are well suited to become an important asset class. And something else they wrote was something like this. Bitcoin is an electronic money. It has no intrinsic value. They said a dollar bill in your pocket is 75% linen and 25% cotton and also has no intrinsic value. Okay? Wish I'd said it. So for people who tell you to look out because the government might have a reaction to Bitcoin, the government is already telling you what its reaction is. Last two risks, and I'm done. Scaling and transaction processing speed. So for people who've heard about that, it's true that Bitcoin transaction processing capacity of 7 transactions per second at the end of last year was woefully inadequate, and there were backups and difficulties and so forth. However, for weeks, or actually months now, there is an upgrade, a new technology add-on called Bitcoin Lightning Network, which has been tested in the marketplace with real commercial transactions, although they've limited it to roughly $35 a transaction because they don't want people to lose too much money if there's a bug while they debug it. It already has the transaction capacity, the speed capacity, meaning 20, 30, 40,000 transactions a second of the Visa network. That's a very big deal and a very serious disruptive threat, which I can't go into, but it's worth reading about. Price volatility is named as another reason for failure, yet this is a problem that's already being solved since there are now Bitcoin futures. It takes time for futures markets to get deep enough and liquid enough, but it's there already. Think of powerful vested interests. Okay, a retailer with a 5% pre-tax margin pays about 60% of its pays about 3 percentage points in fees to the credit card companies and banks, which is about 60% of its profit margin. With a liquid futures market, Walmart or Amazon could establish a flat exchange rate and take the volatility out of it and accept Bitcoin, which now has the transaction speed required. Roughly speaking, Walmart, by our estimates, pays about $12 billion a year in credit card related fees, and Amazon about $6 billion. You think they'll walk away from that? And I've got to stop here. I haven't gotten to the other cryptocurrency asset class, which is cryptocurrency mining. But I'll say what I can about it. Okay. I think that's it. Yeah. If the coin itself, like Bitcoin, has the investment characteristics of enormous potential return but enormous volatility, the other asset class can have the precise opposite profile. And that's the asset class of seniorage, which is the issuance of money for a profit margin. It costs the Federal Reserve 4.9 cents to make a dollar. That's the same way cryptocurrency mining works. Historically, seniorage was the privilege of the ruling power, but now it's the privilege of cryptocurrency miners, essentially anyone who buys an appropriate server. Okay? It's an operating business. It's got assets, it's got cash flow, it's got margins. Its investment profile, at least the way we've done it, is complete absence of price volatility, a very high income production, a number so high I can't say it here, other than to say it's in the high double digits percentage-wise on a fully costed, fully depreciated basis. A completely alternate risk return profile to in-system asset classes. We've experimented and learned with our own capital. We do it for clients now. And there are, by the way, a few non-U.S. publicly traded companies that do qualify still as value investments that engage in mining in a meaningful way, which is a less direct way of participating. And they are as inexpensive as they are because they, too, for various reasons, trade beneath the ETF divide. They're non-index-centric stocks. Anyway, that's it for me. I think I did it on time. Thank you. Thanks.
Thank you all for coming up. We actually are out of time for questions, but I think Steve's going to be here for a little bit. If you all have some questions, we'll be up here in the front of the room. We do have our presentation start in about 8 minutes or so, 5 minutes. So please join us for the rest of the afternoon and join us for happy hour afterwards. I also want to note that these presentations will be up on our website. It's the word 3pa.com. If you click through ideas conferences, you'll find it. And then we did record this, and we'll have the entire presentation with a link up there as well. And then if you get a chance, there's a compilation of Steve's stuff on in a book. There's 40 copies out there, but if you didn't get a copy, 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 but if you didn't